15. As they came closer, I saw their mismatched dark clothes and the grime on their faces. They were all thin limbs and hollow cheeks, as if they had stretched out a great deal in a short period of time. All boys, about my age. All easy to take, if we had to. "Christ on a cracker," the one closest to me muttered, shaking his mop of red hair. "I told you we should have checked the van first." Liam's blonde head popped up from the wreckage. "What the hell are you fools trying to pull?" he snarled. There was another sound, too, like the mewling of a kitten, or a little girl crying. I climbed over a bin of bargain DVDs to get to them. Zoo sat on the floor, her pink palm facing up toward Chubb's squinting eyes. Without the glasses perched on his nose, he looked like a different person.
"She's all right," he said. "No burns."
Liam was suddenly standing beside me, using my shoulder for balance as he climbed over one of the overturned shelves.
"You okay?"
he asked. "Fine," I said. "Pissed. You?"
"Fine.
Pissed." I thought for sure I was going to have to hold him back as we came closer to the cluster of boys, but his fury seemed to fall away from him with each step. The other kids had regrouped beside an overturned display of neon-colored pool noodles. The tallest one, his cloud of frizzy brown hair hovering around a pencil-thin neck, stepped in front of the others, the ginger kid who had spoken before, and two big-shouldered blondes that looked like brothers.
"Look, man, I'm sorry," he said.
"Do you always do crap like this?" Liam said. "Attacking folks without even checking to see if they're armed? If they're like you?" The leader bristled.
"You could have been skip tracers."
"And it was your yellow that did all of this." The ginger kid gestured toward the shelves. "The girl needs a leash."
"Watch your mouth," Liam snapped.
The blonde brothers took a step forward, their eyes lighting at the challenge. "She wouldn't have panicked if you hadn't pulled guns on us."
"We wouldn't have had to use them if you'd paid attention to our warning back there and just left."
"Because you gave us so much time to get away," Liam snapped.
"Look, we could go back and forth forever and it won't solve a damn thing," I interrupted. "We were hoping to spend the night here, but if you've claimed it or whatever, then we'll go. That's the only reason we came, for shelter."
"For shelter," the leader repeated.
"I'm sorry, did I stutter?"
"No,
but my ears are still bleeding from your yellow's meltdown," he snarled. "Maybe you should say it again, baby, for good measure."
Liam shot out an arm, cutting off my warpath before it could start. "We just want to stay here a night. We're not looking for any trouble," he said flatly.
The leader gave me the once-over, his eyes drifting to a stop where my hands were fisted at my side, bunching up my dress.
"Looks like you already found it."
The leader's name was Greg, and he hailed from Mechanicsville, Virginia. The nervous ginger-haired kid refused to introduce himself, but was called Collins by the others. I caught that he was from some town in Pennsylvania, but that was as much as he was willing to share with anyone. The blondes, who were, as I guessed, brothers, were Kyle and Kevin. The only thing the ramshackle group had in common, outside of their pool of food and an alarming pile of firearms and knives, was their camp in New York, which they lovingly referred to only as Satan's Ass Crack. They told the incredibly dramatic and highly improbable tale of their escape from PSF custody over our shared meal of fruit snacks, stale Pringles, and Twinkies.
"Let me get this straight," said Chubbs, his face etched with disbelief. "You were being moved from one camp to another."
Greg leaned back against one of the glass freezer doors.
"They weren't taking us to another camp. They packed up as many guys as they could and said we were being brought to a testing facility in Maryland."
"Only guys?" Chubbs asked.
"We didn't have girls there."
Greg's voice was heavy with disappointment. That explained a lot, particularly why he still seemed to be inching toward me, no matter how far I scooted away.
"Otherwise, I'm sure they would have been loaded up, too."
"I'm surprised they even told you that much," I said, trying to steer the conversation back on track.
"Do you think that's actually where they were bringing you?"
"No," Collins cut in. "It was pretty clear that they had orders to get rid of us." and a storm flooded the road, flipping the bus and allowing you to escape. That was the part of the story I had problems with, too. It was that easy for them? A simple intervention of Mother Nature and they were saved, washed out to freedom and a new life, biblical style? Where was the detail of PSFs traveling with them? We've been holed up ever since. It took something like 6 months to get word to my dad that I was out and safe, and another 3 to get some kind of response from him. Chubbs leaned forward. How exactly did you get in touch with them? The internet?
Nah, man, Greg said. After that terrorist business, you can't even search for recipes online without the PSF snooping and breaking down your door. All they need is one whiff of trouble.
What terrorists? I interrupted.
The League, Chubbs said. Don't you remember?
Ah. He seemed to realize his mistake a second late and, with more patience than I thought he possessed, explained.
3 years ago, the League hacked into the government's side databases and tried posting information about the camps online for everyone to see. Other groups took that as their cue to hack into banks, the stock exchange, the State Department.
So they cracked down on it?
Right. Most of the social networking sites are gone, and all of the email services are required to monitor the emails being sent on their servers.
He turned to the other boys, who were staring at me with varying degrees of interest and curiosity. I don't think Kevin, or was it Kyle, had stopped staring at me the entire time I had sat there.
How then?
Easy, Greg said with a highly unnecessary wink in my direction. We used what was left. I put an ad in my hometown paper with a message only my brother would get. I didn't need to look to know that Chubbs had narrowed his eyes. He tensed beside me.
And who paid for this ad? The editors didn't just let you put that in there for free, did they?
No, the slip kid paid, Greg said. He set everything up for me.
I sat up straight, kicking aside some of the empty foil wrappers.
You've actually been in contact with the slip kid?
Oh, yes. He's like a god, Colin said, his breath rushing out. He gathered all of us together, kids from all over New England and the South, every color, older kids, young ones, too. They say that the PSF stay away from his court in the woods because they're afraid of him. That he set his camp on fire and killed all the PSF sent to bring him back.
Who is he? I asked. The four of them grinned at one another, the jumping shadows from the emergency lights making them look even smugger.
What else? Chubbs said, sucking all of this down eagerly. How was he able to send the money for the ad?
What's East River like?
Where is it?
I glanced back over my shoulder to Liam, who stood behind me, leaning against what used to be a TV dinner freezer. He'd been strangely quiet the entire time, his lips pressed tight together, but his face otherwise perfectly devoid of emotion.
They have a sweet setup at East River, Colin said, but if you want to get to East River, you have to find it for yourself.
Sounds that way, Liam said finally. Are there a lot of kids there?
The four of them had to think about this.
More than 100, but not like in the thousands, Greg said.
Why?
Liam shook his head, but I was surprised to see a hint of disappointment there.
Just wondering? Most never were in camps, I take it.
Some,
Greg shrugged, and some found it after dodging Skip Tracer or PSF custody.
And the slip kid, he doesn't have...
Liam seemed to struggle to figure out how to ask his question.
He doesn't have plans for them, does he? What's his end game?
The others seemed to find the question as strange as I did. It wasn't until Greg said,
"No end game, just living, I guess,"
that I realized I hadn't once thought about the reason why Liam would be looking for the slip kid. I'd just assumed that he and the others wanted to find him to get home and to deliver Jack's letter. But if that really was the case, what had sparked the fire in Liam's eyes? His hands were stuffed into his jacket pockets, but I could see the outline of them curling into fists.
"What about directions?" I asked.
"Well, now."
Something changed in Greg's expression,
A slick smile took over his face as his free hand landed on my foot. The brothers, Kyle and Kevin, hadn't said a word since we'd sat down in their makeshift encampment in the freezer aisles, but now looked at each other with identical expressions of knowing. I tried to gulp back the revulsion rising in me.
"I'm sure they'd be happy to have you," Greg said, his fingers sliding up from my shoe to stroke my ankle.
I started to push away, but stopped when he added, "It's in a really great location near the coast, but there just aren't a whole lot of girls. They could use something so nice to look at."
His fingers moved again, tracing a line up my calf. "You should go. It's safer than getting caught by one of the tribes. There's a group of blue kids that hangs out around Norfolk. They're nasty. Steal the clothes right off your back. There was a tribe of yellows around here for a while, but a kid we were in camp with claims they were all taken in by PSFs. All of this tribe stuff was new to me. Kids banding together and roving the countryside, trying to avoid getting caught, taking care of one another. Amazing.
Greg's warm, fleshy palm continued its ascent until it swallowed up my knee and squeezed, and that was as far as he was ever going to get. I felt the trickle at the back of my mind, the buzz that pushed past even my anger, and had to close my eyes at the flash of images that followed. A glimpse of a shining yellow shell of a school bus coming down a dirt road, a woman's blurry face, her mouth moving in silent song, a campfire flaring up into the night sky, the faces of Kevin and Kyle leaning close to what looked like a clock radio in the middle of a trashed electronics store. The numbers on the clock's face were climbing, but not counting time. They lit an electric green glow in the dark. 310, 400, 460, 500, until it finally stopped on. My hand clenched into a fist as I started to detach from both Greg and his silky swarm of memories, but Chubbs was already there. He reached across my lap and began to peel Greg's fingers off, one by one, with a look of pure disdain. For his part, Greg only looked slightly dazed, his eyes glassy, unaware of what I had just done. I glanced around wildly, my heart lodged somewhere between my mouth and chest, but no one seemed to have noticed my slip. The only one who moved was Chubbs, and it was just to scoot closer to me. "Damn it," I thought, squeezing my eyes shut again. One hand drifted up to press against my forehead, as if I could hold back the invisible fingers there by force. Too close. That was way too close.
"What was that kid's name again? The yellow who worked with us in the kitchen? Fred? Frank?"
Collins lay back on his sleeping bag, folding his hands over his chest.
"Felipe? Felipe Marino?"
Greg's eyes came back into full focus and continued up my legs, past where his hand had been allowed.
"Felipe?" Liam interrupted, as if coming out of a trance. "Did you say Felipe Marco? You know him?"
Liam nodded. "We traveled together for a while."
"Must have been before he got his ass caught here," Greg said. "He was the one that told us about this place. Said he was here with his friend. That you?"
"Yeah."
"What happened to him?"
Liam knelt, wedging himself between Greg and me.
"They brought us to separate camps."
Greg shrugged.
"He was in one of the earlier buses they were taking to Maryland. Who knows?"
So the yellows at their camp had been removed, too. They must have only been taken from the bigger camps, not the smaller ones that had been cobbled together farther west.
"I miss that kid. He was smart, knew how to use his powers. Better than your pet, at least. Might as well send her back for all the good she's going to do for you."
Greg nodded toward Zoo, who was sitting with her back to us, working through the pages of multiplication problems Liam had made for her. And that was about as much as I could take.
"You have 2 seconds to tell me you're kidding," I said, "or I'm punching you in the face."
"Do it," Chubbs hissed beside me. But Liam put a firm hand on my shoulder, effectively shutting down any chance I had of making good on my threat. He kept his face passive, easygoing, but his breath hitched in his throat. He stretched his fingers out, brushing them against mine on the floor. I jolted at the touch, but couldn't bring myself to pull away. Greg held up his hands.
"All I'm saying is there's something off about her. She's not like the others, is she?
He leaned closer.
Is she retarded? Did they do testing on her?
She's mute, not deaf, Liam cut in smoothly, and I promise you she's probably 5 times smarter than the 7 of us put together.
I'm not so sure about that, Chubbs began.
Liam silenced him with a look and brought his lips down next to my ear.
Take Zoo?
I nodded, my fingers tapping his to show that I understood. I pushed myself up off the ground, feeling calmer now. When I reached Zoo, I held out my hand to her. She raised hers without looking up, blindly reaching for mine. I stared at the yellow glove in front of me, streaked with dirt and black grime, and, despite what had happened a few minutes before, pulled it right off her little fingers. I couldn't say why I had done it. Maybe being so close to Liam and not losing control had made me stupidly brave, or maybe I was just sick of the reality that forced her into them. All I knew for sure was that if I never saw Zoo wear those gloves again, it would be too soon. Zoo jerked when she felt the warm skin of my hand against hers and tried to tug away. Her eyes went wide, but I couldn't tell if it was from worry or wonder. Come on, I said, squeezing her hand. Girl time. Her face brightened, but she didn't smile.
Don't go too far, Liam called after us.
Don't go too far,
the other boys echoed, then burst out into laughter. Zoo's nose wrinkled in disgust. I know what you mean, I said, and took her as far away from them as I could. For the first 10 or so minutes we spent walking around the store, Zoo kept turning to look at our linked hands, as if she couldn't believe what she was seeing. Every now and then, some bin of unwanted DVDs or an aisle end cap of pointless knickknacks would catch her attention, but her dark eyes would always wander back to where our hands swung between us. We had just turned down one of the many ravaged cleaning supply aisles when she gave my arm a tug. What's wrong? I asked, kicking aside a stray mop. Zoo pointed at the glove I was twirling around with my free hand. I lifted our hands between us. What's so bad about this? She blew out the breath she had been holding, and it was evident I had missed the point. I was dragged all the way to the other end of the aisle, where she let go of my hand to snatch a white box from the shelf. Zoo went to work tearing the box open, tossing aside the foam and plastic stuffing to get to the old-fashioned silver toaster inside. I'm not sure we're going to need that, I started slowly. She pinned me with a look that very clearly said, Quiet, please. Zoo tugged the other glove off her hand and spread all 10 fingers out along either side of the appliance. After a moment, I saw her shut her dark eyes. The metal piping that served as the toaster's innards heated to a glowing red. A long black cord dangled near her feet, unplugged. The cheap little thing only lasted another minute before its insides started to melt together. I made her put it down at the first sign of smoke. See? She seemed to be saying. Get it? But you can't do that to me, I said, reaching for her hand again. You don't have to worry about hurting me, because you never could. I know how it feels, is what I really should have been saying. I know what it's like to be scared of what you can barely control. I had forced myself to stop thinking about what I had done to that undercover PSF. I didn't let myself wonder if I could do it again, let alone test it out. But how, I wondered, were either of us ever going to learn to control ourselves if we couldn't practice, if we couldn't stretch and test boundaries? Let's see if we can find something useful, I said, slipping my fingers around hers again. I waited until I felt her hand close against mine before leading her back down the aisle. What do you think? I'm not even sure what I was about to ask her, but she wasn't paying attention to me. Zoo stopped so suddenly and gripped my hand so damn hard that I stumbled back a few steps. My eyes followed the line of her outstretched arm to the upended clothing and shoe racks. More specifically, to the lone hot pink dress dangling from an otherwise empty rack. Zoo took off at a run, blitzing down the aisles of extension cords and buckets. I tried to keep up with her, but it was like the wind had caught her heels and was propelling her forward. She stopped just short of the rack. I watched, fascinated, as one of her hands reached out to stroke the fabric, only to pull back at the last second.
Beautiful, I told her. The dress itself flared out at the waist, with a big ribbon bow at the place where the sleeveless top met the pink and white striped skirt. She looked like she wanted nothing more than to pull it down, hug it to her chest, and press her face against the satiny fabric. I could think of about 1,000 things I missed while I was at Thurmond, but dresses were not on that list. My dad's favorite story to tell strangers and indulgent relatives was the day he and Mom tried to button me up into a blue one for his birthday party when I was 3. Because the buttons were so small and impossible for me to reach, I shredded the fabric by hand, bit by gauzy bit. I spent the rest of the party proudly parading around in Batman underwear.
"Are you going to try it on?" I asked.
She looked back up at me and shook her head. Her hands dropped from where they were hovering over the plastic hanger's shoulders, and it took me a moment to recognize what was happening. Zoo thought she didn't deserve it. She thought it was too nice, too new, too pretty. I felt a sweltering hate rise in me, but I didn't know where to direct it. Her parents for sending her away? Her camp? The PSFs? I pulled the dress off the silver rack with one hand and took Zoo's arm in the other. I knew she was looking at me again, her dark eyes wide with confusion. But instead of explaining, instead of trying to force her to understand the words I wanted to say, I led her over to the dressing rooms in the center of the clothing section, thrust the dress into her hands, and told her to try it on. It was like tugging a boat into dock on a thin line. The first few times I handed it to her, she would put it down and I'd have to pick it back up again. I don't know if her desire finally won out or if I'd managed to exhaust even her wariness, but by the time she appeared, peeking out from around her dressing room's door, I was so relieved I almost cried. "You look amazing." I turned her back around so she could see herself in the room's tall mirror. When I finally coaxed her to look, I felt her shoulders jerk under my hands, saw her eyes go huge and bright, only to droop again a moment later. Her fingers began to pluck at the fabric. She was shaking her head as if to say, "No, no, I can't." "Why not?" I asked, turning her so she was looking at me. "You like it, right?" She didn't look up, but I saw her nod. "Then what's the problem?" At that, I caught her sneak another look at herself in the corner of the mirror. Her hands were smoothing the fabric of the skirt, and she didn't seem aware of it in the slightest. "That's right," I said. "There is no problem. Let's see what else we can find." After, she wanted to find something for me. Unsurprisingly, the adult section had been decimated by looters. My choices seemed limited to hunting gear and industrial jumpsuits. After several patient explanations about why I didn't need the silky cornflower blue nightgown or the skirt with daisies on it, she, with a look of total and complete exasperation, accepted that I was only ever going to try on jeans and plain t-shirts. And then she pointed to the bra rack, and a part of me wanted to crawl under the discarded piles of kids' pajamas and die. The letters and numbers might as well have been in Chinese for how much sense I could make of them, and I half expected Zoo to start laughing when the first touch of frustrated tears welled up in my eyes. There were not many times I'd stop and think, "I wish Mom were here." I understood now, at least, that what I had done to her, I could never fix. She would never look at me again and recognize me, and I would never be able to think of anything other than the look in her eyes when she saw me that morning. It was strange how my feelings about her seemed to change by the minute. That one moment I could remember what it felt like for her to brush my hair, and the next, be furious that she had abandoned me, that she hadn't taught me how to live in my own skin and be a girl like she was supposed to. But whose fault was that, really? Zoo's lips puckered in thought, her eyebrows knitting together as she surveyed the Everest of undergarments in front of us. She began to pluck one of every size, tossing them back toward me until both of us were laughing ourselves silly for no real reason at all. Eventually, I found what I thought might have been the right fit for me. It was hard to tell. They had all been so damn uncomfortable with their wires and pinching straps. While I changed out of my dress, Zoo happily pulled together an outfit for herself that looked like something out of a store catalog.
The pink dress, white leggings beneath it, and a jean jacket that was one or two sizes too big for her. The rest of the things she found were stuffed into a flower-patterned backpack I pulled down off a display for her. Now that she had found her own things, she wanted to go the whole hog and pick out things for the boys, too. When I found her a new pair of tennis shoes with rosy laces, she actually wrapped her arms around my waist and hugged me, like she could squeeze the thanks into me. And while Zoo was not especially impressed by the pair of short black boots I found for myself in the men's section, she didn't try to force any of the ribbon flats or towering high heels on me. Zoo was in the process of neatly folding a button-down shirt she had chosen for Chubbs when I remembered something.
"I'll be right back," I told her. "Wait right here, okay?"
It took me a few minutes to find the aisle again. Liam and I had walked past it so quickly as we made our way toward the back of the store, I wasn't altogether sure that I hadn't imagined seeing them. But there they were, just above the cleaning supplies. A pair of bright pink rubber gloves dangling amid a sea of traditional yellow ones.
"Hey, Zoo!"
I called as I made my way back to her. I dangled them out in front of me and waited for her to turn around. When she did, her mouth actually fell open. She was so dazzled by her new gloves that she walked with her hands stretched out in front of her, the way a princess examining the collection of fine jewelry around her fingers and wrists would. I watched her curtsy and twirl in her new dress as we lapped the store, all the while her feet dancing over the evidence of what had happened at the checkout lanes. Watching her, feeling the exhilaration swelling in my chest, I couldn't say I was all that aware of the broken glass and flickering monitor displays either. We turned down the dimly lit corridor of cosmetics, and I could barely keep the grin off my face. Liam found us there a short while later, just as Zoo was tying off the braid she'd woven in my hair with a glittery hair tie. I sat on the tile, and she sat on the shelf behind me like some fairy queen.
"Magnificent," I told her when she held a broken mirror out in front of my face. "You are incredible."
And my reward for that was the feeling of her arms' bird-like bones twining around my neck. I twisted around so that I was facing her, because I wanted her to see my face. I wanted her to see how serious, how sincerely I meant it when I repeated myself. "You are incredible."
"You two have been busy, I see."
Liam leaned against the aisle's end cap, eyebrows raised. Zoo bounded toward him, scooping up the shirts and socks she'd picked for him.
"Thank you. Oh, God, Chubbs is going to piss his pants when he sees this."
His hand came down to rest on top of her head.
"Geez, I leave you two alone for a little while and you clean out the joint. Good job."
I pushed myself up off the floor, helping them gather up the clothes and supplies we'd managed to scrounge up. That done, we started our slow, reluctant shuffle back to the others. All three of us seemed to be aware that once we left that peaceful moment, it would be behind us forever. Zoo had only just darted out a few steps ahead of us when Liam turned to me and said, "Thanks for doing this. I'm glad you got what I meant." He gave my braid a little playful tug. "I just wanted to ask them a few more questions." "And you didn't want," I nodded toward Zoo, "to hear?" He looked down at his feet. And when he looked back up, his ears were pink.
"Yeah, but also, you were kind of distracting them."
"What? I'm sorry I threatened them or whatever, but..."
"No distracting them,"
Liam repeated, "with your face."
"Oh."
I recovered quickly. "Did you get anything useful out of them?" "The names of a few of the friendlier tribes, a few cities under lockdown for insurrection, stuff like that. I just wanted to get a sense of what was happening in Virginia." "I meant about the slip kid," I said, maybe a little too eagerly.
"Nothing we didn't have before. Apparently everyone takes some sacred oath not to reveal more information than that. Totally ridiculous."
"They really wouldn't give you any more information?" I said. Liam looked down at the ground.
"Greg made us an offer. A trade, but we turned him down."
"What did he want?"
"What was so valuable that they wouldn't trade it for the one thing that would reunite them with their families? Black Betty?"
"Doesn't matter," Liam said, and there was a finality in his voice.
If those numbnuts managed, I'm sure we can find East River ourselves. Eventually.
Yeah, I said with a light laugh. True. Out of the corner of my eye, I watched him hoist the pile of clothes onto his shoulder, his gaze never leaving where Zoo was hopping and skipping through the field of cans and old magazines. I glanced down at a blonde movie star's face as we passed it, my eyes falling over the words, "She finally tells all," printed under her face.
"Can I ask you something?"
"Of course," he said. "What's up?"
"Why are you looking for the slip kid?" I asked. I felt his eyes on me, and I knew what explanation was coming.
"I mean, besides wanting to help Chubbs and Zoo get there, and trying to deliver Jack's letter.
Is it because you want to go home, or..."
"Any reason in particular you're asking?"
His voice was even. Testing. "The questions you were asking them about the camp," I explained. "It just seemed like you were trying to figure something out." Liam didn't reply for a long while. Not until the tents they'd set up for the night were in sight. Even then, it wasn't an answer.
"Why do you want to find the slip kid?"
"Because I want to be able to see my grandmother.
Because I need to understand how to control my abilities before they destroy everyone I care about."
"But you didn't answer my question." Zoo dashed through our tent flap, and the lantern in the tent lit up Chubb's delighted face. When she handed his new things over, he folded her into an enormous hug, lifting her off her feet with the force of it.
"It's the same as you," he said. "I just want to get home."
"Where's that?"
"See, that's the funny thing," he said. "It used to be North Carolina, but I'm not so sure anymore."
We stood staring at each other for a moment, nearly toe to toe, and when he lifted the flap of the tent for me, I couldn't help but wonder if he had picked up on my half-truth as easily as I had picked up on his. 16. It was an hour, maybe more, before Liam's breathing evened out and he began to snore. He slept flat on his back, his hands resting against the soft flannel of his shirt. His face, which earlier had seemed marked by old, bruising shadows, looked young again. He might have been able to pass as a 20-year-old with his facial scruff and solid build, but he didn't fool anyone while tucked away in sleep. His face was turned toward Zoo, who slept between us under a mountain of blankets and was currently the only thing that was keeping me from inching closer to him, from slipping my hand under his bigger one and learning the contents of his dreams. But the distance between us was there for a reason. Imagining a future in which I didn't exist, in which I had unwittingly erased myself from his memories, kept my hands pinned under my legs and my mind, for once, in check. When I heard Greg and his pals stir in their tents next to ours, I finally gave up all pretense of sleep. Their voices began as a low murmur, indistinguishable from one another, and grew louder as the minutes ticked by. Finally, they turned their lantern on to the lowest setting, just enough to be visible through our own green tent's shell. I slipped out the other side of the tent, careful to keep my footsteps soft against the concrete. Their whispers grew in volume and urgency the closer I came.
"Them?" Greg mumbled. "We don't owe them anything."
My hands clenched at my side, all of the anxiety and distrust that had been swelling up inside of me over the past few hours coming to a head. For a single second, I wished that I had brought my backpack inside the store with me. The panic button was there, waiting to be used if the situation blew up fast and ugly. "Stupid, Ruby," I thought. "Stupid." I wasn't worried about taking care of Greg and his friends. Even with their guns, we still had a chance. But if they tried to pull something while we were asleep, or if they called in reinforcements... My feet stopped mid-stride. Chubbs had beaten me to guard duty. He sat facing the tents, his long, spidery legs crossed in front of him, and Zoo's workbook in his lap. He was leaning toward the others' tents, concentrating so hard on picking up their conversation that he missed my approach and nearly jumped out of his skin when I appeared.
"Zoo?"
He squinted in my direction.
"Zoo?" I whispered back. "Really? I mean, really."
I took Zhu's workbook and pencil out of his hands and flipped the page without looking at whatever he had been writing. "What are you doing?" I wrote, showing it to him. He rolled his eyes and refused to respond when I tried to put the pencil back in his hand. "Do you think they're going to try something?" After a moment, he sighed and finally nodded. "Me too," I scribbled. "Come with me?" By the way his shoulder slumped, Chubb seemed to think he didn't have much of a choice. He stood quickly and quietly, wiping his palms against the front of his khaki pants. "I have a bad feeling about this," Chubb said when we were out of earshot. The tents were in our line of sight, but we weren't in theirs. "About them."
"Do you think they're going to try to rob us?"
"I think they're going to try to take Betty, actually."
There was a long pause. I felt Chubb's eyes slide over to me, but my own were fixed on the tents, watching for trouble.
"You should go back to sleep."
There was a gruff edge to his voice as he crossed his arms over his chest, but there was also something about the way he said it that made me wonder if he was waiting to see what I would reply.
"What are you even doing up?"
"Same as you, I guess," I said, "making sure no one gets brutally mugged, beaten, or murdered in their sleep. Watching to see if those kids are the assholes I think they are." Chubb snorted at that, rubbing his hand over his forehead. It took some time in silence, but I felt the air between us ease from a guarded hostility to something that felt to me like acceptance. His shoulders were no longer bunched up with tension, and when he tilted his head toward me, I saw it for the subtle invitation it was. I took a step closer.
"It was bad enough he had to come back here?" Chubbs mumbled, more to himself than to me. "God."
"Liam?" I asked. "This is where he and his friend were captured, right?"
Chubbs nodded. "He's never told me the whole story, but I think what happened was that he and Felipe were traveling and ran into a tribe of Blues. Instead of recruiting them, like Lee hoped, the tribe beat the hell out of them and stole everything they had. Food, packs, family pictures, you name it. They came here for a few days to regroup, but they were in such bad shape that they couldn't get away when the skip tracers finally showed up."
Something hard settled in my throat.
"Lee thinks that that tribe probably called them in," Chubbs continued, "that they got a cut of the reward."
I didn't know what to say. The thought of a kid, of any of us, turning against our own kind made me want to smash the shelf we were leaning against into a heap of metal.
"I trust Liam," I said slowly. "He's such a good person, but he's so easy for others to read, and they don't have the best intentions."
"Exactly," Chubb said. "He's so busy looking inside people to find the good that he misses the knife they're holding in their hand."
"And even then he'd probably blame himself for the person having the knife to begin with and apologize for being such a tempting target."
That was what troubled me the most about Liam. If he was any more trusting and good-hearted, he would have been a Boy Scout.
It was either an amazing feat of stubbornness or naivete, I thought, for someone who had seen so much death and suffering to still believe so unconditionally that everyone was as stand-up as he was. It was something that inspired both exasperation and a fierce sense of protectiveness in me. And Chubb's, too, it seemed.
"I think we both know he's far from perfect, no matter how hard he tries," Chubb said, settling himself down on the ground and leaning back against the empty shelf. "He's never been a big thinker, that one. Always rushing to do whatever his gut tells him to, and then drowning in his own self-pity and guilt when things blow up in his face."
I nodded, absently fiddling with a tear in the sleeve of my new plaid shirt I hadn't noticed before taking it. After hearing Liam with Zhu, I knew that he felt an intense guilt over what had happened the night of their breakout, but it sounded like it might run even deeper than that.
"I can fix that for you later."
Chubbs nodded toward the torn fabric. His long fingers were splayed out over his knees, tapping against the bones.
"Just remind me."
"Who taught you to sew, anyway?" I asked. Apparently, it was not the right question to ask. Chubb's back went stiff and straight, like I had dropped an ice cube down the back of his shirt.
"I don't know how to sew," he snapped. "I know how to stitch. Sewing is for decoration. Stitching is for saving lives. I don't do this because I think it's pretty or fun. I do it for practice." He stared at me over the rims of his glasses, waiting to see if I got what he was trying to say.
"My dad taught me how to stitch before I went into hiding," he said finally, "in case of emergencies."
"Is your dad a doctor?" I asked.
"He's a trauma surgeon."
Chubbs didn't bother to hide the pride in his voice.
"One of the best in the D.C. area."
"What does your mom do?"
"She used to work for the Department of Defense, but got fired when she refused to register me in the IAAN database. I don't know what she's doing now."
"They sound great," I said. Chubbs snorted, but I could see him warm to the compliment. The minutes dragged by, and the conversation waned. I found myself reaching for Zoo's notebook and flipping it open to the beginning. The first few pages were mostly sketches and doodles, but those gave way to page after page of math problems. Liam's handwriting was neat and precise, and, surprisingly, so was Zoo's. Betty traveled 118 miles in 3 hours. How fast was Lee driving? "You have 5 Snickers bars to share with 3 friends. You cut them in half. How many will each friend get? How can you make sure the leftovers get shared equally so Chubbs doesn't complain?" And then I got to a page with completely different handwriting, messy and smeared. The letters were darker, as if the writer had been pressing down on the paper too hard. I'm not sure what else can be said about this book that hasn't already been said. I'm out of clever things to say, I'm afraid. Jonathan Swift has always been a favorite, but I can't get over how clever his wordplay is throughout the novel. I really can't get over how similar it is to Robinson Crusoe at times, especially when he's on the ship to Lilliput. Though his interaction with the Lilliputians wasn't the strongest section, you would be hard-pressed to find equally clever interplay of parody and originality. I can see why the book has been studied so carefully by scholars over the years. We meet Gulliver as a dreamy young man in search of adventure, trying to get anywhere that would involve sea travel, and see him evolve masterfully. If I had to name the best section of the book, it would probably be the Lilliputian section, a place I would greatly like to visit, because my own head is often stuck in the clouds, and to be able to study philosophy and mathematics all day, a dream. There was a time or two over the course of the novel that I felt Swift had gone overboard and missed some opportunities to drive home his idea of what the ideal society should be. You, as the reader, are left to figure it out for yourself. This book is perfect if you love thought-provoking literature from an objective, rational viewpoint, or if you dream about one day traveling the world yourself. I held the page up for him to see. "This yours?" "Give me that," he said. His face was wild with panic. Not just panic. By the way his nostrils flared and his hand shook, it was almost like I had scared him half to death. Guilt shot through me. I passed it back to him and watched him tear that sheet of paper out. "Hey, I'm sorry," I said, worried about the tinge of green coloring his face. "I didn't mean anything by it. I'm just wondering why you'd practice writing essays when you said you didn't think we'd ever get to go back to school." He continued to stare at me for several seconds, until something in his stony expression finally gave. Chubbs blew out the breath he'd been holding.
"I'm not practicing for school."
Instead of tucking the sheet of paper inside the briefcase, he laid it out between us.
Before camp, my parents thought the PSFs were investigating them, which, you know, they were. They sent me up to my grandparents' cabin to hide, and you remember what I said about the internet being policed? We had to find a way around it, especially when they started putting pressure on Mom at work.
I glanced down at the sheet of paper again. "So you used to send book reviews?"
"I had a laptop and a few wireless internet cards," he said. "We would post book reviews online. It was the only way we could think of to talk without them catching on."
He leaned over, covering the paper so only the first column of words was visible. "I'm out. Can't get to you. Can meet anywhere. Name, place, and time. Missed you. Love you."
"Oh." "I wanted to write it out now," Chubb said, "in case I can get online, but only have a few minutes."
"You're pretty genius,"
I said slowly. Your whole family. I got a snort in response. Duh.
The question I really wanted to ask him was inching its way up my throat when he pulled a deck of cards out of his briefcase.
Want to play a few games?
He asked.
We're going to be here a while.
Sure, but I only know Old Maid and Go Fish.
Well, he cleared his throat. We don't have the right deck for Old Maid, and, unfortunately for you, I excel at Go Fish. I won the Go Fish tournament in fifth grade.
I grinned, waiting for him to deal my cards. You're a star, Chubbs. His nose wrinkled at the name. I can't call you by anything else if I don't know your real name.
Charles, he replied. Charles Carrington Merriweather IV, actually.
I tried to keep my face straight as possible. Of course he would be named something like that.
Okay. Charles? Charlie? Chuck? Chip?
Chip?
I don't know. I thought it was kind of cute.
Just call me Chubbs. Everyone else does. I figured it out. It must have been 5:30 in the morning, well after several delirious games of cards and charades that had been brought on by too much candy and too little sleep. Both of us had been waiting for the other shoe to drop, to be proven right about the other boys. We kept the baseball bat beside us and never once turned our backs to the tents. When exhaustion finally set in, we took turns curled up on the ground, trying to steal a few minutes of sleep here and there. I picked up Zoo's notebook again in an attempt to avoid being lulled to sleep by Chubb's rhythmic snores, and added a few clouds and stars to the first page of doodles. The pages fanned out under my fingers as I flipped through the notebook again, not catching until I found what I was looking for. 540. It was an area code for this part of the state, I was sure of it. Grams had lived down near Charlottesville for a time, and I had a very vague memory of standing in the kitchen of my parents' house, staring at her number printed on a notepad beside the phone. But the area it covered, that was no small bit of land, and there was no real guarantee that it was supposed to represent an area code in the first place. It was easier to think of it now without three eager sets of eyes on me, but slightly complicated by the fact that I was running on fumes, sleep-wise. With more than enough time to kill, I started in again, rearranging them, trying to create anagrams, substituting different letters for others. The feeling snuck up on me slowly, crawling back up through the crowded, tired portions of my brain. The other number, 540, where had I seen that? Why did it feel like... When it came to me, I almost laughed. Almost. I had seen the number on the radio in Greg's memory only a few hours earlier, burning brightly through even the murkiest clouds of his thoughts. It was 5:40 a.m., a radio station. Shaking Chubbs back awake wasn't enough for me, not when I thought I would actually burst at the seams with excitement. I all but pounced onto Chubbs' back, both scaring him senseless and kneeing him in the kidney in the process. I'm not sure what sound he made when I landed, but I was fairly certain it wasn't human.
Wake up! Wake up! Wake up!
I hissed, hauling him huffing and puffing and cursing to his feet.
When they gave you EDO, did they say anything else?
Green, if I can still walk tomorrow, so help me God.
Listen to me, I hissed. Did they say anything about tuning in or picking it up?
He fixed me with a baleful look.
All they said was to check out Edo.
Check out, I repeated. Those exact words.
Yes, he said, exasperated. Why?
I was wrong before, I said. I don't think the number has anything to do with a phone number. We were right before. The last letter isn't a letter at all. It was supposed to be a zero. 540. It's some kind of radio station.
How in the world did you reach that conclusion?
Ah, the tricky part in all of this. How to BS the fact that I had cheated and seen the answer rather than being in possession of brain power to actually work it through. I was trying to think of what else uses three-digit numbers. When I remembered hearing them, Greg and the others, I mean, talking about needing to find a radio here.
I should have mentioned it to you guys before, but I didn't think anything of it until now.
Oh, my God.
Chubbs was shaking his head, mildly stunned.
I don't even believe it. We have honestly had such shit luck this entire trip. I thought at least two of us were going to end up dead in a ditch somewhere before we figured it out.
We need a radio, I said. I think I'm right. But if I'm not, we need to test it before telling the others.
Betty?
No. I wasn't about to leave the tent unguarded, even for 15 minutes. I thought I saw a radio in the back. Let me go grab it. The store was rushing around me in dark streams and fading colors as I ran, but I wasn't afraid of what was lurking there. Not now. I hadn't imagined the radio after all. It was back in the small cluster of rafts and blankets that Liam and his friend had set up the last time he was here. Chubbs was pacing in front of the shelves by the time I got back. I set the small device up on a shelf that was about eye level and began to fuss with its buttons, searching for the on switch. I had to be the one to start it up, and the one to fumble with the volume knob when it just about blew our eardrums out with static. The thing was ancient, a beat-up silver box, but it worked. The speakers jumped between voices, commercials, and even a few old songs I recognized.
It has to be AM, Chubbs said, taking the radio in his hands. FM frequencies don't go up past 108 or so. Here we go.
My first thought was that Chubbs had somehow tuned it to the wrong station. I had never heard a sound like the one sputtering through the speakers. A low growl of static pierced by what sounded like a tub of broken glass being tossed around. It wasn't painful like the white noise, but it wasn't pleasant either. But Chubbs was still grinning.
"Do you know what this is?"
he asked, and was all too happy to explain when I shook my head.
"Have you heard that there are certain frequencies and pitches that only kids with a psi brain can pick up?"
I braced a hand on the shelf to keep from doubling over. I had. Kate had told me as much when she explained the camp controllers had embedded a certain frequency in the white noise to root out any of the dangerous ones still hiding out in the other cabins.
"It's not so much that others can't hear the noise. It's that their brains translate the sounds differently than ours do. Really fascinating stuff. They did some testing with it at Caledonia to see if there were any pitches that certain colors couldn't pick up and others could, and it always sounded like this when we couldn't."
No sooner had the words left his mouth than there was another sharp click, and the noise cut off altogether, replaced by a soft male voice whispering, "If you can hear this, you're one of us. If you're one of us, you can find us. Lake Prince, Virginia." That same message three times before it clicked again and switched back to the frequency we had heard before. For a long time, Chubbs and I could only stare at one another, speechless.
"Oh my God," Chubbs said.
"Oh my God." And then we were saying it together, jumping up and down, arms flung around one another like two damn fools, like we had never, ever wanted to reach over and slap each other multiple times on multiple days. I hugged him without any kind of fear or self-consciousness, fiercely, with a rush of emotion that almost brought tears to my eyes.
"I could kiss you," Chubbs cried.
"Please don't," I gasped out, feeling his arms tighten around my ribs to the point of cracking them. Either by his internal clock or Chubbs' excited squeaks, Liam woke first. I saw him out of the corner of my eye, his head of tousled blonde hair sticking out of the tent. He looked between us once and retreated back into the tent, only to reemerge a second later looking torn between confusion and worry.
"What's wrong?" he asked. "What's going on?"
Chubbs and I glanced at each other, wearing identical grins.
"Get Zoo," I said. "You guys are going to want to hear this."
17. According to Chubbs, Jack Fields was the second son in a family of five kids and the only one to survive idiopathic adolescent acute neurodegeneration. His father had owned an Italian restaurant and his mother died of cancer when he was young. Jack was unremarkable in appearance, the kind of kid you would pass in a school hallway and not think twice about. But he was stealth cool, the only one in their room that knew what Liam was talking about when he started in on Japanese horror flicks or articles from back issues of Rolling Stone. Apparently, he liked to tell stories in weird voices and spent years scratching out a replica of New York City's skyline on the converted classroom's blackboards. The PSFs assigned to their room had been so impressed with the sheer detail of his work that they actually let him finish. More importantly, Jack took great pleasure in antagonizing the camp controllers by using his abilities to lift things off their belts and out of their pockets, or to throw things into their paths so that they'd trip and fall in front of everyone. To hear Chubbs talk, you would have thought Jack Fields was a saint walking on earth, a disciple of awesome, preaching the proper way to use their blue abilities after spending years figuring it out for himself. Which was probably why he was the first one the camp controller shot in the back of the head the night the kids tried to make their escape. Liam was silent as we approached Petersburg's outer city limits, only nodding once or twice to confirm that the craziest parts of Chubb's tale were true. He had been just as excited as the two of us when we dragged him over to listen to the broadcast, but slowly, over the course of a few hours, his mood had deteriorated. When Chubb's stories died out, so did all conversation in the van. "It's supposed to be really beautiful there," I said suddenly, then winced at how awkward it sounded. "Lake Prince, I mean." Liam didn't look stressed so much as profoundly sad. That was what worried me, that he was sinking into something that not even our breakthrough could pull him out of. "I'm sure you're right," he said quietly. He handed me the half-folded map. "Can you put this back in the glove box?" I certainly hadn't been looking for it when I opened the small compartment, but there they were, nested on top of a pile of crumpled napkins. Truthfully, I had been expecting envelopes, or at the very least lined notebook paper, which was stupid and didn't make any sense because it's not like their camp had arts and crafts days. It's not like they were just given the paper and pens. Still, I had been expecting the letters to be something heavier, for Chubbs and Liam to be carrying theirs with them. Jack's letter was on top, written on half of what looked like a computer printout, folded over several times. He had managed to squeeze his father's name in tight capital letters on the back of the paper, between the large black words, "Area Restricted." Instead of putting the map away, I took the letter out, only vaguely aware of the argument Liam and Chubbs had gotten into over the best route to Lake Prince. I wasn't thinking much of anything as my finger slid over the wrinkled surface, smoothing it out as I unfolded it. No date in the upper right-hand corner, just a hasty, straight-to-the-point, "Dear Dad." I didn't get to take in another word. Liam reached over and ripped the paper out of my hand, crumpling it slightly in his fist. "What are you doing?" he demanded. "I'm sorry, I just..." "You just what?" he barked. I felt my body jerk in response. "It's personal. It's none of your business what it says." "Lee," Chubb said, sounding every bit as surprised as I felt. "Come on." "No, this is serious. We don't read each other's letters." "Never?" I said. "What if you can't find his dad and the letter has some clue about where he might be?" Liam was shaking his head, even as Chubb said, "She has a point." He said nothing, but his hands trembled on the steering wheel. It was his silence that stung, and when I couldn't take another second of it, I reached over and turned on the radio, sending up a prayer that an Allman Brothers song would be on. Instead, Betty picked up a news talk show. "Children are in containment for their own good, not just the safety of the American public. My well-placed sources in the Gray administration have informed me that all instances in which a child has been removed from rehabilitation early have resulted in their untimely death. There is simply no way to reproduce the routine of medication, exercise, and stimulation these rehab centers are using to keep your children alive." Liam punched a knuckle against the volume button, trying to turn it off. Instead, the tuner jumped to the next available station, and this time it was a woman's voice delivering the bad news. "Sources are reporting that two Psi fugitives were picked up on the Ohio-West Virginia border, traveling on foot." Betty turned so hard and fast into the empty rest stop that I swore she did it on two wheels. Liam parked diagonally across three different spaces, throwing the brake on with a fast, Be right back. 1 minute he was beside me, and the next we were watching the back of his red flannel shirt as he jumped over a puddle of stale rainwater and headed for the colonial-style brick building and vending machines. That was dramatic. I turned to look at Chubbs over the seat, but he was just as confused as I was.
You should probably follow him, Chubbs said.
What should I say? Chubbs gave me one of his looks.
Really? You need me to spell it out for you?
I had no idea what he meant, but I went anyway, tracing Liam's trail of anger and frustration past the restrooms, past the abandoned sitting area, to the other side of the building, where there was wild, long grass, trees, and absolutely no way we could have seen him from Betty. He stood with his back toward me, sagging against the rest stop's wall, arms crossed over his chest, hair standing on end. I thought I was being quiet like a fox, but he knew the moment I stepped behind him. His grief hung around us like humidity, seeping into my skin. I felt the invisible fingers at the back of my mind awaken, howling like a feral cat that had been caged too long. I kept my distance.
Lee,
I'm okay. Go back to the van. Again, with a forced, bright voice. He dropped to a crouch, then completely to the ground. But I didn't move, not until he leaned forward and stuck his head between his knees, looking like he was about to throw up everything in his stomach. I stared long and hard at the place where his light hair curled against his neck, at the exact spot an old bruise disappeared down his shirt collar. My hand lifted at my side to push the soft fabric away. I wanted to see how far the ugly mark extended, to see what other old wounds he was hiding.
You touched him before, a little voice whispered at the back of my mind, and nothing happened then.
Instead, I took a step back and away, so I was no longer standing directly behind him, but off to the side. Distance. Distance was good.
You're right, you know, he said quietly. I don't want to find the slip kid just to deliver Jack's letter. I don't even want to use him to help me find my family. I know where they are and how to reach them, but I can't go home. Not yet.
Somewhere behind us, I heard one of Betty's doors slide open, but it didn't break the stillness of the moment.
Why not? I'm sure your parents miss you.
Liam rested his arms over his knees, his back still to me.
Did Chubbs tell you?
Did he say anything to you about me and the League? He couldn't see it, but I still shook my head.
Harry, my stepdad, he knew from the start that the Children's League was bad news, said they would use us worse than Gray ever would, and wouldn't shed one damn tear if we died helping them. Even after Claire. Claire was my little sister. He cleared his throat. Even after she was gone, he used to remind me that no amount of fighting was ever going to bring her back. Cole had already joined up with them, and he came back to get me to go with him, to fight.
Was my sister. Was gone. Another victim of IAAN.
I bought into it. I was so angry, and I hated everyone and everything, but there wasn't anyone to direct it at. I was there with them for weeks, training, letting them turn me into this weapon, into the kind of person that would take an innocent person's life just because it served their needs and what they wanted. My brother was like a stranger. He even kept this thing he called a kill chart in our room. And he'd add to it every time he killed someone important, every time he completed a mission. And I would come in after training all day, and I'd look at it and think, how many of those people had families? And how many of those people had people who needed them like we needed Claire? And that's just it. They all did, Ruby. I'm sure of it. People don't live like islands.
So you got out? He nodded. Had to run during a training simulation outside. I was trying to get back to Harry and Mom when the PSFs picked me up. He finally turned, so he was looking at me.
I can't go back to them yet. Not until I earn it. Not until I make it right.
What are you talking about? While I was with the League, I realized that the only people that were ever going to help us were ourselves. So when I figured out a way to break out of Caledonia... Liam's voice trailed off. Then he said, "It was horrible. Horrible. I totally failed them, even after I promised it would work out in the end. So why..." His voice caught. "You heard what that newscaster said. Only a few of us got out, so they just keep picking us off like rabbits in hunting season. So why do I want to do it again? Why can't I shake it? All I want is to help more kids break out of Caledonia, out of Thurmond, out of every single camp, one by one." "Oh," I thought, feeling vaguely numb. "Oh." I had only ever wanted to find the Slip Kid to help myself, to figure out how to tame my abilities. But all along, Liam had wanted to find him because he was sure he'd be able to help others. That, together, they could figure out a way to save the kids we'd all been forced to leave behind. "It's just so unfair, you know? All this morning I kept thinking, it's so goddamned unfair that I'm here, so close to finding East River, and the rest of them are gone." He pressed the back of his hand to his eyes. "It makes me feel sick. I can't shake it. I can't. Those kids they were talking about on the radio, I'm sure they were from Caledonia. I just..." He took in a ragged breath. Do you think they regret following me?" "Not for a second," I said. "Listen to me. You didn't force them to follow you. You only gave them what the PSFs and camp controllers took away from them. A choice. You can't live in a place like those camps and not know what the consequences might be. If those kids followed you out, it was because they chose to. They believed you when you said we'd all get home someday." "But most of them didn't." Liam shook his head. "In some ways, it would have been safer for them to stay in the camps, right? They wouldn't have been hunted. They wouldn't have had to see how afraid everyone is of them or felt like they don't have a place out here. But isn't it better to give them that choice?" I asked. "Is it?" My head was pounding and my shoulders ached. By the time I finally thought of something to say, Liam was climbing up onto his knees. "What are you still doing here?" "Not upset or angry. Not anymore." "Watching your back?" He shook his head, a sad smile on his face. "You've got better things to worry about." "I'm really sorry." The words tumbled out of me in a breathless rush. "I shouldn't have opened his letter. It was none of my business. I wasn't thinking." "No. No, I'm the one that's sorry. I didn't mean to blow up at you. God, it was like Dad was talking through me. I'm so, so sorry." Liam looked down, and when he looked back at me, his lips were pressed tight together. I thought he might cry or scream, and felt myself sway forward at the same time he took another dangerous step toward me. It made me feel boneless to meet his gaze straight on, but I wanted the truth from him, even as I worried the intensity of his gaze would burn me. "Come on, let's go back." He shook his head. "I'm fine. I shouldn't have left those two alone again." "I think you need another minute," I said, "and I think you should take it, because when you get back in that car, you'll have people depending on you." He tried to reach for my arm, but I took a step back. "I don't know what you're..." he began. God, I wanted to take his hand when he offered it. Mine were frozen, needled with pain. "Here," I motioned between us. "This is a place where you don't need to lie. I meant what I said before, but I can't help you if you don't tell me what's really going on inside your head. If you need to talk or vent or scream, do it with me. Don't just get up and go like that again, like you always do. I know you think you're protecting us, but Lee, what happens if one of these days you go off and don't come back?" He took a step toward me, his eyes darkening with something I didn't recognize. It never occurred to me how tall he was, but he seemed to tower over me then, leaning down until our faces were level with each other. I could see what I would have done if our situation had been different, if I had been in control of myself. I could see what he wanted. What I wanted. My foot slipped against a rock as I stepped away, my back scraping against the wall, my head sending me spiraling into panic. It was trilling in anticipation, relishing how close he was. Maybe his anger had evaporated, but whatever he was feeling now was stronger than before, stronger than pain or frustration or fury. The words, "get away from me," and "don't," were stuck in my tight chest, wedged between terror and want. Liam's lips formed my name, but there was nothing outside of the blood rushing in my ears. I tried one last time to wrench myself away, but my knees, the traitors, buckled under me. Spots in every shade of the rainbow popped and burst in front of my eyes. And that's when he grabbed me. Only this time, it was to hold me up, not pull me to him. It didn't matter. The moment his hand circled my waist, he was gone. 18. My eyes were shut, but I could imagine what must have happened, how his pupils must have shrunk and then dilated, open and vulnerable, waiting for a command. Liam's mind was a blur of colors and lights. One moment I was standing next to a young blonde boy in overalls, clutching a woman's hand. Then I was balancing on the front bumper of an old car as a gentle-faced man with strong arms pointed out the engine. I saw the face of a kid rocket back as I punched him in the nose, heard a roar of approval from a circle of boys formed around us. I stared at Chubb's long legs as they hung over the edge of the top bunk, and then I was standing in front of Black Betty, watching Zoo climb into the back seat, looking frail and hungry. And then I was seeing me. I was seeing me with the sunlight reflecting off my dark hair, laughing my fool head off in the passenger seat. I didn't know I could look like that. No. No, no, I don't want to see... I slapped him across the face. The sound echoed up through the tree branches. Pain flared in my hand, spreading quickly up my arm to the center of my chest. I heard something else, too. A snap, like a dried-out wishbone being pulled apart. I reeled back, as if he had been the one to hit me. I almost wished he had, because the pain would have distracted me from the dizzy disorientation that came next. I panicked. I knew from countless experiences at Thurmond that the best way to break a connection was to do it slowly, carefully, unravel the invisible threads linking us together one by one. Wasn't this exactly what had happened with Sam? One wrong touch, and I had pulled back so hard and so fast from her mind that I ripped away every single trace of me. Wasn't it? Wasn't it? The pain lessened the farther I dragged myself away from him. Ruby? Why did I always have to do this? Why couldn't I just hold it together for once? Liam was staring at me. At me, not through me. He looked focused, if not completely bewildered. My eyes fell on the red welt forming on his cheek. Had I heard that right? My name? What the hell just happened? He let out a strangled laugh. I feel like I just got hit by a linebacker. I slipped. What could I possibly say? The truth was on the tip of my tongue, dangling there. But if he knew what I had just done to him... And there I was, trying to be all valiant and stuff by catching you? He chuckled, using the closest tree to help him stand. Lesson learned. You're falling next time, darling, because, man, you have a hard head. I'm sorry, I whispered. I'm so, so sorry. Liam stopped laughing. Green, you know I'm just kidding, right? Really, it takes a special kind of guy to get knocked out by the same person he's trying to catch. Aside from bringing back a few humiliating memories of school sports, I'm fine, honestly. What? Do you even remember what we were talking about? Oh my God, he said, all of a sudden noticing I was still on the ground. Are you okay? I can't believe I didn't even ask. Are you hurt? I avoided the hand he offered. It was too soon. I'm fine, I said. I think we should head back now. You left Betty running. My voice sounded calm, but inwardly, I was such a desert. All of the hope that had sprung there, growing and spreading and yielding like a stream, had dried up in an instant. I had slipped up, but he didn't know. They never did. This couldn't happen again. I was lucky this time. He still remembered me, even if he couldn't recall what I had done. But there was no guaranteeing that luck would hold. No more touching. No more fingers brushing against arms or shoulders pressed against shoulders. No more taking his hand, no matter how warm or big it was. That alone was a reason to find this slip kid, to beg him to help me. Yeah. Yeah. He nodded, but I didn't miss the way his brows furrowed when he looked my way again, or the grinding ache in my chest when he passed by and didn't let his hand reach for mine. I stayed 5 steps in front of him as we made our way back around the rest stop, past the water fountains, through the silver benches and tables under the overhang. I moved faster, practically jogging as I came around the corner. I half expected to see Chubbs and Zoo outside trying to rig the vending machines into burping up whatever snacks they had left. But it wasn't Chubbs waiting there for me, and it certainly wasn't Zoo. Dark hair, darker eyes, a man that couldn't have been older than 25, with a scar that began just under his right eye and raced up to his hairline, where the shiny pink skin had prevented any hair from growing back. My brain processed his features one by one in agonizing slowness. I watched as his face twisted, turning his narrow nose up in disgust. Liam called my name in a panic, his feet thundering against the cement. "Run!" I wanted to scream to him. "What are you doing? Run!" I turned back to face the man, the skip tracer, in his wrinkled blue windbreaker, just in time to see the butt of his rifle flying down toward my face, knocking every thought clear out of my skull. Pain blinded me, flashing white beneath my eyelids, but I was down, not out. When the man tried to haul me up by the front of my shirt, I swung a leg around and caught him by the ankles. He landed on the ground with a grunt, his gun clattering against a nearby patch of rocks. I kicked until I made contact with something solid. I knew it wasn't enough. I tried pushing myself up to my feet, but the world swung wild and loose under me. My head throbbed, and something hot and wet poured down over my right eye. Blood. I could taste it then, just as plainly as I felt the air move as Liam lifted the man clear off the ground with a wave of his hand. He threw him like a rag doll into the sharp edges of the picnic tables, knocking the skip tracer out in a single blow. Zoo. Chubbs. Zoo. Chubbs. My mind was stuck on a loop. I pressed a hand against my forehead, to the place where the gun had burst the skin in a jagged line. I don't know what happened next. It felt like my head was skipping seconds as we moved. At one point, I think Liam must have tried to help me up, but I pushed him away with clumsy, slow hands. Run, I tried to say. Get out of here. Ruby. Ruby! Liam was trying to get my attention because he hadn't seen what was up ahead. Zoo and Chubbs were sitting on the ground, outside of Betty. Their hands were handcuffed behind their backs, and their feet tied straight out in front of them with a length of bright yellow rope. Standing over them was none other than Lady Jane. This was the first time I had seen her up close. Close enough, at least, that I could make out the beauty mark on her cheek and the sunken quality to her eyes behind the black frames of her glasses. Her dark hair was down around her shoulders and curling with the humidity, but her skin still looked as though it had been pulled taut over the sharp angles of her face. Her black shirt was tucked neatly into her jeans, and a black utility belt was there to keep them both in place. I recognized the countless devices hanging from the belt. The orange identifier, a taser, handcuffs. "Hello, Liam Stewart," the woman said, her accent cold and silky. Next to me, Liam braced his feet and threw his arms up, to knock her back, I think. The woman only tisked, nodding ahead toward her outstretched left arm. My eyes followed its angle downward, to the gun pointed at Zoo's head. "Lee!" Chubb's voice was unnaturally high, but it was the look in Zoo's eyes that planted me in place. "Come here," the woman said, "slowly, with your hands on top of your head. Now, Liam..."
Otherwise, I can't be sure that my finger won't slip.
She cocked her head to the side. Panic, I thought. The panic button, where? My backpack was somewhere tucked under the front passenger seat. If I could get to it, if I could reach the door.
Yeah? Liam spat. And what's the going rate for me these days? How much did it get cut back when it took you 3 weeks to finally catch up to us?
Her smile faltered, but returned with far more teeth than before.
You're still at a healthy $250,000, love. You should feel proud of that. You barely fetched me $10,000 the first time around.
Liam was vibrating with rage, too choked up to speak. I heard his breath catch in his throat. I suddenly understood how he had known so much about her. This was the same woman who had captured him before.
You can't imagine my surprise when your name popped back up in the bounty database, and with that kind of reward. It seems that you've gotten yourself in a fair bit of trouble since we last met.
Yeah, well, Liam said, his voice rough, I do my best.
But, darling, how could you be stupid enough to go back to that place? Didn't you think I'd look for you there?
The woman tilted her head again.
Your friends were only too willing to tell me where you were headed and why, in exchange for letting them go. Lake Prince, is it?
My pain gave way again to fear. If she finds East River. God, I couldn't even imagine the consequences. Liam could, from the look of it. His knuckles were white with the effort it took to keep his fingers clutched in his hair.
If I can pull in that much for you, imagine what I'll get for a whole camp full of kids, she said. Enough to finally buy my way home, I think, so thank you for that. You have no idea what kinds of funds it takes to get an official to look the other way and admit someone from a disease-ridden country.
The next second of silence that passed was deafening, only because I knew exactly what he would say next.
If you let them all go, you can have me, he said, both hands still on his head. I won't give you any trouble.
No, Chubb shouted. Don't!
The woman didn't even need a moment to consider it.
You think I'm going to do you any favors? No, Liam Stewart, I'm going to take all of you, even that girl of yours. Maybe you should consider her condition before you try to bargain.
His eyes slid my way, taking in the blood streaking down my face. I tried to keep my vision straight as I took the tiniest step forward.
I don't know where you came from, little girl, but I can assure you that where you're going won't be nearly as pleasant.
I'm not going back. None of us were, not if I could help it.
Come here, she said,
her eyes on me, but her gun still trained on Liam.
You first, little girl. I'll take special care of you.
I went one step at a time, ignoring Liam's sharp intake of breath and the buzzing in my ears. My eyes went from Chubb's to Zoo to the woman's all-too-pleased face. Everyone was watching me. Everyone will know. And no one would be willing to have me after that.
Turn around, the woman barked.
Her eyes flickered over to where her partner was still hidden behind a tangle of picnic tables. I saw her grip relax ever so slightly on her handgun, with her focus torn, and I took my chance. My knee flew up, nailing her just under her chest. The gun clattered to the ground, and I heard Liam take 2 running steps in my direction, but somehow I was faster. Blood was alive and warm on my face, dripping from my chin. The woman's eyes widened as my hand closed over her exposed throat, slamming her back against Betty's door. When her gaze met mine, I knew I had her. The pain that exploded behind my eyes told me so. Slipping into her head was as easy as releasing a sigh. Seeing her pupils shrink and explode back out to their normal size, it felt as though someone had wrapped a line of barbed wire around my brain and was tightening it with every passing second. Chubb's face appeared at the corner of my vision, eyes wide. When he tried to stand, I knocked him back down with my foot. No, it wasn't safe. Not yet. The woman looked around, her eyes wide and unfocused.
That's when the pounding began in my ears. Da-da, 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 da-da. I couldn't tell if it was my heart or hers.
"Hand him your gun," I said, tilting my head toward the place I knew Liam was standing. When she didn't move, I pushed the image of her doing it through the bubbling black shapes of her mind. I couldn't bring myself to look at his reaction as the black weapon was placed in his outstretched hand.
"Listen to me very carefully," I said. The blood was bitter in my mouth. "You are going to turn and walk back across the highway. You are going to walk into that forest and keep walking until an hour passes, and you are going to sit down in the middle of it and not move. You're not going to eat or sleep or drink, no matter how much you want to. You're not going to move."
Imagining that into her mind, pushing the thought of her doing exactly that, was becoming more difficult. Not because my grip on her was slipping, but because my grip on consciousness was. "You can do this," I told myself. It didn't matter that no one had ever taught me, or that I had never practiced. In the end, it was all instinct, like I had known all along. I closed my eyes and went to work sorting through the darkened memories bubbling up behind her eyes. I found myself driving down the highway, one hand on the wheel, the other pointing to the rest stop up ahead. I parked the car a ways back, half hidden by the trees, and began to walk toward the lone black van in the parking lot. I stayed with this memory, taking in the scent of rain and grass, feeling the light breeze, until her partner reached the van, his rifle up and ready to fire. I forced the memory out of her mind, imagining nothing but air where Black Betty had been in the parking lot. I traced the line of memories back to the boys at Walmart, to the secret they had revealed about East River. The images slipped away in smears of light, like raindrops racing down a car window.
"Now, you won't remember any of this, or any of us."
"I won't remember any of this," she parroted, as though the thought had just occurred to her.
I let go of her neck, but my pain didn't go away. Her eyes regained some of their focus. The pain didn't go away. She turned sharply on her heel and started to make her way toward the deserted highway. The pain didn't go away. No, it got worse. A trickle of sweat began at my temple and worked its way down the length of my spine. I was drenched. My hair clung to my face. My shirt was a second skin. I dropped into a crouch. If I was going to faint, it was better to stay close to the ground.
God, I don't want to faint. Don't faint. Do not faint.
I heard Liam say something. His foot came into my line of sight, and I leaned away.
"Don't," I began. "Don't touch me. Not right now."
And it was strange because the last thing I saw before I closed my eyes wasn't the old asphalt. It wasn't the sky or even my reflection in Betty's panels. It was a glimmering memory of my own, of a few days before when Liam had been in the driver's seat, singing along to Derek and the Dominoes' "Layla" at the top of his lungs, so off-key that it even had Chubbs laughing. Zoo had been sitting right behind him, moving in time with the music, her entire body rocking out to the wailing electric guitar. And it had been so easy then, to laugh and pretend, even if just for a second, that we would be okay, that I belonged with them. Because they hadn't known. None of them had known. And now that they did, it was over. It was all over now, and I would never have that back. I wished that I had gone for the panic button. I wished that Kate could come and take me away from them, back to the only people who would ever embrace me for the monster I was.
19. When I was about to turn 10 years old, the most significant thing about that number wasn't that it was double digits. It didn't really feel much like a birthday anyway. At dinner, I sat bookended by my parents at the table, moving peas around my plate, trying to ignore the fact that neither of them were speaking, to each other or to me.
Mom's eyes were rimmed with red and glassy because of the argument they'd had a half hour before. She was still valiantly trying to gather up kids for a surprise birthday party for me, but Dad forced her to call and cancel. Said it wasn't the kind of year to be celebrating, and, as the last kid alive on my block, it would be cruel of us to hang the birthday banner and tie up the usual cluster of balloons outside. I heard the whole thing from the top of the stairs. I didn't really care about the birthday either way. It wasn't like I had anyone left I really wanted to invite. What was more important to me was the fact that, at 10, I was suddenly old, or rather, would be old soon. I'd start to look like the girls in the magazines, be forced to wear dresses and high heels and makeup, go to high school. In 10 years from tomorrow, I'll be 20. I don't know why I said it out loud. It was just this profound realization, and it had to be shared. The silence that followed was actually painful. Mom sat straight up and pressed her napkin to her mouth. For a moment, I thought she might stand up and leave, but Dad's hand came down to rest on top of hers, settling her like an anchor. Dad finished chewing on his barbecued chicken before giving me a smile that quivered at the edges. He leaned down a ways, so our identical green eyes met. "That's right, little bee. And how old will you be 10 years after that?"
30, I said, "and you'll be 52.
He chuckled. "That's right, halfway to the grave," my mind whispered. "Halfway to the grave." Dad realized his mistake before the word fully left his mouth, but it didn't matter. All three of us knew what he meant. Grave. I knew what death was. I knew what happened after you died. At school, they brought in special visitors to talk to the kids that came back. The one assigned to our room, Miss Finch, gave her presentation 2 weeks before Christmas, wearing a bright pink turtleneck and glasses that covered half of her face. She wrote everything out on the whiteboard in thick, capital letters. Death is not sleeping. It happens to everyone. It could happen at any time. You do not come back. When people die, she explained, they stop breathing. They do not have to eat. They no longer speak. And they cannot think or miss us like we miss them. They do not ever, ever wake up. She kept giving us more examples like we were too stupid or little to understand, like the six of us left hadn't sat there and watched Grace's lights go out. Dead cats cannot purr, and dead dogs cannot play. Dead flowers, Miss Finch pointed to the bundle of dried flowers on my teacher's desk, do not grow or bloom anymore. Hours of this. Hours of being asked, "Do you understand?" But for all of her answers, she never got around to the one question I had wanted to ask. What does it feel like? Dad looked up sharply.
What does what feel like?
I looked down at my plate. To die, do you feel it? I know that it's not the same for everyone, and that you stop breathing and your heart stops beating. But what does that feel like?
Ruby!
I could hear the horror in Mom's voice. It's okay if it hurts, I said. But are you still in your body after things stop working? Do you know that you've died?
Ruby!
Dad's bushy eyebrows drew together as his shoulder slumped.
Well, don't you dare! Mom said, using her free hand to try to pry his big one off her other trembling fingers. Jacob, don't you dare!
I kept my hands clenched together under the table, trying not to stare at Mom's face as it paled from a deep red to a stark white.
No one, Dad began. No one knows, sweetheart. I can't give you an answer. Everyone finds out when it's their time. I guess it probably depends.
Stop it, Mom said, slapping her other hand down on the table. Our plates jumped in time with her palm. Ruby, go to your room.
Calm down, Dad told her in a stern voice. This is important to talk about.
It is not. It absolutely is not. How dare you? First you cancel the party, and when I told you...
She strained against his grip. I watched, my lips parting as she picked up her water glass and threw it at his head.
In ducking, he lifted his hand from the table, just enough for her to wrench away and stand. Her chair clattered to the ground a second after the glass shattered against the wall behind Dad's head. I screamed. I didn't mean to, but it slipped out. Mom came around to my side of the table and grabbed me by the elbow, hauling me up, nearly taking the tablecloth with me.
Cut it out, I heard Dad say.
Stop. We have to talk to her about it. The doctor said we needed to prepare her.
You're hurting me, I managed to choke out. Mom startled at the sound of my voice, looking down at where her nails were digging into the soft skin of my upper arm.
Oh, my God,
she said, but I was already in the hallway, flying up the stairs, slamming my bedroom door shut and locking it behind me, closing out the sound of my parents screaming at each other. I dove under my heavy purple bed covers, knocking the row of carefully arranged stuffed animals to the ground. I didn't bother to change out of the clothes I had worn to school or turn off the lights, not until I was sure my parents were still in the kitchen and far away from me. An hour later, breathing the same hot air under the comforter in and out, listening to the rattle of the air vent, I thought about the other significant thing about turning 10. Grace had been 10. So had Frankie and Peter and Mario and Ramona. So had half of my class, the half that never came back after Christmas. 10 is the most common age for IAAN to manifest, I had overheard a newscaster saying, but the affliction can claim anyone between the ages of 8 and 14. I straightened my legs out and pressed my arms in at my sides. I held my breath and shut my eyes, staying as still as possible. Dead. Miss Finch had described it like a series of stops and knots. Stopped breathing, not moving, stopped heart, not sleeping. It didn't seem like it should have been that simple.
When a loved one dies, they don't get to wake up, she had said. There are no comebacks or do-overs. You may wish they could come back, but it's important that you understand they can't, and they won't.
Tears slipped down the side of my face, dripping into my ears and hair. I turned to the side, smashing a pillow over my face, trying to block out the screaming match downstairs. Were they coming up to my room to yell at me? Once or twice I heard heavy footsteps on the stairs, but then Dad's voice would float up to me, booming and terrible, yelling words I didn't like or understand. Mom sounded like she was being gutted. I drew my legs up to my chest and pressed my face against my knees. For every two breaths I was taking in, I was lucky to get one out. Inside my chest, my heart had been racing for what felt like hours, jumping with every shatter or thud from downstairs. I stuck my head over the covers just once to make sure that I had locked the door. That would make them even angrier if they tried it, but I didn't care. My head felt light and heavy all at once, but worst of all was the pounding. The dum, dum, dum at the back of my head, like something was inside of me knocking against my skull, trying to break out.
Stop it, I whispered, squeezing my eyes shut against the pain.
My hands were shaking so hard I couldn't keep them over my ears.
Please, please stop.
Hours later, when my feet carried me downstairs, I found them in their dark bedroom, deep into sleep. I stood in the sliver of light coming through their open doorway, waiting to see if they would wake up. I had half a mind to climb into bed between them like I used to do, into that small space between them that I knew was warm and safe. But Dad had told me I was too big to be doing such silly things. So, instead, I walked over to my mom's side of the bed and kissed her goodnight. Her cheek was slick with rosemary-scented cream, cool and smooth to the touch. The instant I pressed my lips there, I jumped back, a flash of white burning inside my eyelids. For one strange second, the image of my own face had leaped to the front of a long series of jumbled thoughts, then disappeared, like a photo drifting into dark water. Her blanket must have shocked me. The jolt traveled all the way up to my brain, flashing it white for a second. She must not have felt it because she didn't wake up. Neither did Dad, even when the same strange thing happened.
As I made my way back upstairs, the tightness in my chest vanished, lifting away with the comforter as I kicked it to the floor. The head-splitting pain released its grip on my brain, leaving me feeling like my tank had run empty. I had to close my eyes to block out the sight of my room swaying in the darkness. And then it was morning. My alarm went off at 7 exactly, switching over to the radio, just as Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road was starting. I remember sitting straight up in bed, more surprised than anything. I touched my face, my chest. The room seemed unnaturally bright for so early in the morning, despite the curtains being closed, and within only a few minutes the headache had crept back in, claws out. I rolled out of bed and onto the floor, my stomach turning with me. I waited until the dark spots had stopped floating in my eyes, and tried to swallow to ease my dry throat. I knew this feeling. I knew what the clenching in my guts meant. Sick. I was sick on my birthday. I stumbled out of bed, changing into my Batman PJs on the way to the door. Mom would be even angrier at me if she knew I had slept in my nice button-down shirt. It was wrinkled and drenched in sweat, despite the cold clinging to my bedroom window. Maybe she'd feel bad about the night before and let me stay home to show how sorry she was. I wasn't even halfway down the stairs when I saw the wreckage in the living room. From the landing, it looked like a pack of animals had gotten in and had a field day throwing around pillows, overturning an armchair, and smashing every single glass candle holder that had been on the now cracked coffee table. Every picture on the fireplace mantle was face down on the ground, as were the line of school portraits my mom had placed on the table behind the couch. And then there were the books. Dozens of them. Mom must have emptied out every book in the library in her anger. They littered the ground like rainbow candy. But as scary as that room was, I didn't feel like throwing up until I reached the last step and smelled bacon, not pancakes. We didn't have many traditions as a family, but chocolate pancakes on birthdays was one of them, and the one we were least likely to forget. For the past 3 years, they'd forgotten to leave out milk and cookies for Santa, somehow forgotten their pact that we would go camping every 4th of July weekend, and even, on occasion, forgot to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. But forgetting the birthday pancakes? Or maybe she was just mad enough at me not to make them. Maybe she hated me after what I had said last night. Mom had her back to me when I walked into the kitchen and shielded my eyes from the sunlight streaming through the window above the sink. Her dark hair was pulled back into a low, messy bun, resting against the collar of her red robe. I had a matching one. Dad had bought them for Christmas the month before. "Ruby red for my Ruby," he had said. She was humming under her breath, one hand flipping the bacon on the stove, the other holding a folded newspaper. Whatever song was stuck in her head was upbeat, chipper, and, for a moment, I really did think the stars had aligned for me. She was over last night. She was going to let me stay home. After months of being angry and upset over the tiniest things, she was finally happy again. "Mom?" Then again, louder. "Mom!" She turned around so quickly she knocked the pan off the stove and nearly dropped the gray paper into the open flame there. I saw her reach back and slap her hand against the knobs, twisting a dial until the smell of gas disappeared. "I don't feel good. Can I stay home today?" No response. Not even a blink. Her jaw was working, grinding, but it took me walking over to the table and sitting down for her to find her voice. How did you get in here?" "I have a bad headache and my stomach hurts," I told her, putting my elbows up on the table. I knew she hated when I whined, but I didn't think she hated it enough to come over and grab me by the arm again. "I asked you how you got in here, young lady. What's your name?" Her voice sounded strange. "Where do you live?" Her grip on my skin only tightened the longer I waited to answer. It had to have been a joke, right? Was she sick, too? Sometimes cold medicine did funny things to her. Funny things, though, not scary things. "Can you tell me your name?" she repeated. "Ouch!" I yelped, trying to pull my arm away.
Mom, what's wrong?
She yanked me up from the table, forcing me onto my feet.
Where are your parents? How did you get in this house?
Something tightened in my chest to the point of snapping.
Mom!
Mommy, why?
Stop it, she hissed. Stop calling me that.
What are you?
I think I must have tried to say something else, but she dragged me over to the door that led out into the garage.
My feet slid against the wood, skin burning.
What's wrong with you?
I cried. I tried twisting out of her grasp, but she wouldn't even look at me. Not until we were at the door to the garage and she pushed my back up against it.
We can do this the easy way or the hard way. I know you're confused, but I promise that I'm not your mother. I don't know how you got into this house, and frankly, I'm not sure I want to know.
I live here, I told her.
I live here. I'm Ruby.
When she looked at me again, I saw none of the things that made Mom my mother. The lines that formed around her eyes when she smiled were smoothed out, and her jaw was clenched around whatever she wanted to say next. When she looked at me, she didn't see me. I wasn't invisible, but I wasn't Ruby.
Mom! I started to cry. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be bad. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Please, I promise I'll be good. I'll go to school today and won't be sick, and I'll pick up my room. I'm sorry. Please remember. Please.
She put one hand on my shoulder and the other on the door handle.
My husband is a police officer. He'll be able to help you get home. Wait in here and don't touch anything.
The door opened and I was pushed into a wall of freezing January air. I stumbled down onto the dirty, oil-stained concrete, just managing to catch myself before I slammed into the side of her car. I heard the door shut behind me and the lock click into place. Heard her call Dad's name as clearly as I heard the birds in the bushes outside the dark garage. She hadn't even turned on the light for me. I pushed myself up onto my hands and knees, ignoring the bite of the frosty air on my bare skin. I launched myself in the direction of the door, fumbling around until I found it. I tried shaking the handle, jiggling it, still thinking, hoping, praying that this was some big birthday surprise, and that by the time I got back inside, there would be a plate of pancakes at the table, and Dad would bring in the presents, and we could pretend like the night before had never happened, even with the evidence in the next room over. The door was locked.
I'm sorry,
I was screaming, pounding my fists against it.
Mommy, I'm sorry, please.
Dad appeared a moment later, his stocky shape outlined by the light from inside of the house. I saw Mom's bright red face over his shoulder. He turned to wave her off and then reached over to flip on the overhead lights.
Dad,
I said, throwing my arms around his waist. He let me keep them there, but all I got in return was a light pat on the back. You're safe, he told me in his usual soft, rumbling voice.
Dad, there's something wrong with her,
I was babbling. The tears were burning on my cheeks.
I didn't mean to be bad. You have to fix her, okay? She's...
I know. I believe you. At that, he carefully peeled my arms off his uniform and guided me down so we were sitting on the step, facing Mom's maroon sedan. He was fumbling in his pockets for something, listening to me as I told him everything that had happened since I walked into the kitchen. He pulled out a small pad of paper from his pocket.
Daddy,
I tried again, but he cut me off, putting down an arm between us. I understood. No touching. I had seen him do something like this before, on Take Your Child to Work Day at the station. The way he spoke, the way he wouldn't let me touch him. I had watched him treat another kid this way, only that one had a black eye and a broken nose. That kid had been a stranger. Any hope I had felt bubbling up inside me burst into a thousand tiny pieces.
Did your parents tell you that you'd been bad? He asked when he could get a word in. Did you leave your house because you were afraid they would hurt you?
I pushed myself up off the ground.
This is my house, I wanted to scream. You are my parents.
My throat felt like it had closed up on itself.
You can talk to me, he said very gently. I won't let anyone hurt you. I just need your name, and then we can go down to the station and make some calls.
I don't know what part of what he was saying finally broke me, but before I could stop myself, I had launched my fists against him, hitting him over and over, like that would drive some sense back into him.
I am your kid, I screamed. I'm Ruby.
You've got to calm down, Ruby, he told me, catching my wrists. It'll be okay. I'll call ahead to the station, and then we'll go.
No!
I shrieked.
No!
He pulled me off him again and stood making his way to the door. My nails caught the back of his hand, and I heard him grunt in pain. He didn't turn back around as he shut the door. I stood alone in the garage, less than 10 feet away from my blue bike, from the tent that we had used to camp in dozens of times, from the sled I'd almost broken my arm on. All around the garage and house were pieces of me. But Mom and Dad, they couldn't put them together. They didn't see the completed puzzle standing in front of them. But eventually they must have seen the pictures of me in the living room, or gone up to my mess of the room.
That's not my child,
I could hear my mom yelling through the walls. She was talking to Grams. She had to be. Grams would set her straight.
I have no child. She's not mine. I already called them. Don't. Stop it. I'm not crazy.
I had to hide. I couldn't let him take me to the police station, but I also couldn't dial 911 to get them help. Maybe if I waited it out, they'd get better on their own? I dashed toward the storage tubs on the other side of the garage, squeezing past the front of Mom's car. One, maybe two steps more, and I would have jumped inside the closest tub and buried myself under a pile of blankets. The garage door rolled open first. Not all the way. Just enough that I could see the snow on the driveway and grass and the bottom half of a dark uniform. I squinted, holding a hand up to the blinding blanket of white light that seemed to settle over my vision. My head started pounding, 1,000 times worse than before. The man in the dark uniform knelt down in the snow, his eyes hidden by sunglasses. I hadn't seen him before, but I certainly hadn't met all the police officers at my dad's station. This one looked older. Harder, I remembered thinking. He waved me forward again, saying, "We're here to help you. Please come outside." I took a tentative step, then another. "This man is a police officer," I told myself. "Mom and Dad are sick, and they need help." His navy uniform looked darker the closer I got, like it was drenched straight through with rain. "My parents..." The officer didn't let me finish. "Come out here, honey. You're safe now." It wasn't until my bare toes brushed up against the snow and the man had wrapped my long hair around his fist and yanked me through the opening that I even realized his uniform was black. When I finally came to in the gray light, I knew by the curve of the rear seat and the smell of fake lemon detergent that I was back in Betty. The van wasn't on and running, and the road wasn't passing underneath me, but the keys had been left in the ignition and the radio was on. Bob Dylan whispered the opening verse of Forever Young through the speakers. The song cut off abruptly, replaced by the DJ's flustered voice. "Sorry about that," the man let out a nervous, breathy laugh. "I don't know why the system brought that one up. It's on the no playlist. Back to the music. This one's a request from Bill out in Suffolk. Here's We Gotta Get Out of This Place by The Animals." I opened one eye and tried to sit up with zero success. The throbbing in my head was so brutal I had to clench my teeth to keep from getting sick all over myself. A good 5 minutes must have passed before I felt strong enough to reach up and touch the pain's epicenter on my right temple. My fingers brushed against the jagged, raised surface of my skin, feeling each coarse stitch holding it together. Chubbs. I pulled my right arm in front of me. It flopped around, useless and asleep, until the blood began to fill it again. Then it was fire and needles. But the pain was good. It roused the rest of me from its stubborn sleep. It didn't let me forget. I should go, I thought. Now, before they get back. The thought of seeing any of their faces made my chest feel like it was going to explode. They know. They know. I did start to cry then. I wasn't proud of it, but I knew I couldn't go through this again and come out of it in one piece. Footsteps sounded outside.
Saying it's too dangerous.
Chubbs.
We need to consider getting rid of her.
I don't want to talk about this right now. Liam sounded agitated. I used one of the seat belts to pull me upright. The sliding door was wide open, giving me a perfect view of where Chubbs and Liam stood in front of a small fire, which was ringed by a series of mismatched stones. The sky was dipping into night.
When are we going to talk about it then?
Chubbs said.
Never. We're just going to pretend like it never happened.
Zoo will be back soon.
Good, Chubbs shouted. Good. This is her decision, too. This is all of our decision, not just yours.
Liam's face was as red as I had ever seen it.
What the hell are we supposed to do, just dump her here?
Yes, I thought. That's exactly what you should do. And I had started to climb over the middle seats to tell them that much when Chubbs lurched forward, throwing Liam onto his back without touching him. Unfazed, Liam pressed his mouth into a tight line, raised his hand, and literally pulled the ground out from under his friend's feet. Chubbs hit the dirt with a sharp gasp, too stunned to do anything but lie there. Liam stayed on the ground, too, pressing his fists against his eyes.
"Why are you doing this to us?" Chubbs cried. "Do you want to get caught?"
I know," Liam said. "This is my fault. I should have been more careful."
"Why didn't you just tell me?"
Chubbs continued.
"Did you know this whole time? Why lie about it? Do you even want to get home or..."
"Charles!" His name cracked as it left my throat. I didn't think I sounded anything like myself, but the boys recognized my voice at once. Chubbs' face lost some of its heat as he turned to where I stood clutching the minivan's sun-warmed frame. Liam pushed himself up off the ground.
"I'm gonna go."
"So you..." "Don't fight anymore, okay?" I said.
"I'm sorry I lied to you. I know I should have left, but I wanted to help you get home, because you had helped me. And I'm sorry. I'm so... so sorry."
"Ruby," Chubbs said. Then again, louder.
"Ruby!" "Oh, for the love of..." "We were talking about Black Betty, not your orange ass."
I froze. I thought... I understand why you would leave me behind.
"Huh?"
Liam looked horrified.
"We left the radio on in case you woke up, so you'd know that we didn't leave you."
God help me, that only made me cry harder. When a girl cries, few things are more worthless than a boy. Having two of them just meant that they stared at each other helplessly instead of at me. Chubbs and Liam stood, up to their ears and awkward, until Chubbs finally reached out and patted my head like he would have patted a dog.
"You thought we wanted to get rid of you because you're not really green?"
Liam sounded like he was having a hard time wrapping his head around that.
"I mean, I'm not thrilled you didn't trust us enough to tell us the truth, but that was your secret."
"I trust you, I do," I said, "but I didn't want you to think that I had forced my way in or manipulated you. I didn't want you to be afraid of me."
"Okay, first," Liam said, "why would we think that you pulled a Jedi mind trick on us to let you stay? We voted. We asked you.
Second, what in the name of God's green earth is wrong with being orange? You have no idea what I'm capable of."
"Exactly," Chubbs cut in. "We have no idea, but it's not like we're going to win any awards for normalcy anytime soon. So you get into people's heads. The two of us can throw people around like toys. Zoo once blew up an AC unit, and all she did was walk by it."
It wasn't the same, and they didn't understand that.
"I can't always control it like you can," I said. "And sometimes I do things. Bad things. I see things I shouldn't. I turn people into things they aren't. It's horrible. When I'm in someone's head, it's like quicksand. The more I try to pull free, the more damage I do."
Chubb started to say something, only to stop. Liam leaned down so his face was level with mine, so close that our foreheads were nearly touching. "We want you," he said, his hand slipping through my hair to cup the back of my neck. "We wanted you yesterday, we want you today, and we'll want you tomorrow. There's nothing you could do to change that. If you're scared and you don't understand your crazy abilities, then we'll help you understand. But don't think, not for one second, that we would ever just leave you." He waited until I was looking him in the eye before continuing. "Is this why you acted that way when I said the slip kid might be an orange? Is that really why you want to find him? Or do you just want to go to your grandmother's? Because either way, darling, we'll get you there." "Both," I said. Was it so wrong to want both? I had stopped crying, but my lungs felt sticky, heavy, and getting in even an ounce of air was too much effort. I don't know why my brain was as still as it was, but I was trying not to think about it. Liam and Chubbs both took an arm. I was lifted out of the van, guided over to the crackling fire. "Where are we?" I asked finally. "Somewhere between North Carolina and the Great Dismal Swamp, I hope," Liam said, his hand still on my back, now rubbing circles there. "Southeast Virginia. Now that you're awake, I need to check on Zoo. You two stay put, okay?" Chubbs nodded. We watched Liam go in silence. Then Chubbs turned to me. "Ruby," he began, voice perfectly serious, "can you tell me who the president is?" I blinked. "Can you tell me why you're asking this question?" "Do you remember what happened?" "Did I?" The memory was milky and distorted, like I was glimpsing someone else's dream. "Angry man," I said. "Rifle. Ruby's head. Ouch. Cut it out, I'm being serious." I winced, touching the stitching in my forehead again. "Can you keep your voice down? It feels like my head is about to cave in." "Yeah, well, serves you right for scaring the hell out of all of us. Here, keep drinking this," he said, handing me what was left of our water bottle. It didn't matter that the water was stale or warm. I finished it off in one gulp. "I mean, my dad used to say that head wounds look worse than they actually are, but I legitimately thought you were a corpse." "Thanks for stitching me up," I said. "I'm looking a little Frankenstein, but I guess it's appropriate, all things considered." Chubbs gave me a weary sigh. "Frankenstein is the name of the doctor that created the monster, not the monster itself." "Couldn't let that one go, could you?" "Don't get on my case about it. You're the one that doesn't know her classic literature." "Funny, I don't think they had that one in Thurman's library." I hadn't meant for it to come out as sharply as it did, but it wasn't a pleasant experience being reminded that your education level equaled that of a 10-year-old. He had the decency to look apologetic as he let out a deep sigh. "It's just, take it easy, will you? My heart can only take so much stress." All along, while listening to Chubbs and Liam try to talk me down, some part of me had been trying to work through the argument I had overheard. I could understand, as horrifying as it was, the need to leave Betty behind. The PSFs and skip tracers all seemed to know to look for her now. But there had been something else underlying their words, something else that had them at odds. I had a feeling I knew exactly what it was, but I couldn't ask Liam. I wanted the truth, not a sugar-coated version of it. The team reality take. Only Chubbs could give that to me. But I hesitated, because next to his feet on the ground between us was Chubbs' copy of Watership Down, and I kept thinking about this one line, the one that had made me so angry the first time I read it as a little kid. "Rabbits need dignity, and, above all, the will to accept their fate." In the book, the rabbits had come across this warren, this community, that accepted food handouts from humans in exchange for accepting that some of them would be killed by the same humans in return. Those rabbits stopped fighting the system, because it was easier to take the loss of freedom, to forget what it was like before the fence kept them in, than to be out there in the world struggling to find shelter and food. They had decided that the loss of some was worth the temporary comfort of many.
Will it always be this way? I asked, drawing my knees up to my chest and pressing my face against them. Even if we find East River and we get help, there's always going to be a Lady Jane around the corner, isn't there? Will it even be worth it? The will to accept their fate. In our case, that fate was to never see our families again, to always be hunted and chased down to every dark pocket of earth we tried to hide inside. Something had to give. We couldn't live that way. We weren't made to. I felt him drop a heavy palm on the back of my head, but it was a long time before he could piece together his thoughts.
Maybe nothing will ever change for us, he said. But don't you want to be around, just in case it does?
I don't know if it was the smoke from the campfire that calmed me, or the sudden reappearance of Zoo, who had come back from scouting a nearby campsite, making sure it was deserted. As she wrapped her arms around my waist, the boys began to pool together what was left of the food and Betty.
So that's how you figured out the clue, Liam said. You saw a memory of it?
I nodded. Not so impressive now, is it?
No, no, that's not what I meant, Liam said, adding quickly, It's just I'm trying to imagine what the inside of that kid's head looked like, and the best I can come up with is a swamp filled with alligators. It must have been terrible.
Not as terrible as slipping into someone's head I actually like, I admitted.
Did you?
Chubb said after nearly 10 minutes of silence. Liam was busy testing out whether he could use Betty's car key to pry open the lids of the fruit and soup cans.
Did I what?
Did you ever get inside our heads? He finished. The way he asked reminded me of the way a kid would ask for the end of a bedtime story. Eager. Surprising. In all of my nightmares about them finding out the truth, I had pictured Chubbs taking it the worst.
Of course she's in our heads, Liam said, his arm straining to open the can's lid. Ruby is one of us now.
That's not what I meant, Chubbs huffed.
I just want to know how it works. I've never met an orange before. We didn't have any at Caledonia.
That's probably because the government erased them all, I said, dropping my hands in my lap.
That's what happened to them at Thurmond.
Liam looked up, alarmed.
What do you mean?
For the first 2 or 3 years I was there, we had every kind of color, even red and orange, I said. But no one really knows why or how it happened. Some people thought they were taken away because of all the trouble they caused, but there were rumors they were being moved to a new camp where they could do more testing on them. We just woke up one morning and the reds, oranges, and yellows were gone. And it was just as terrifying for me to think about it now as it was then.
What about you, though? Chubbs asked. How did you avoid getting bussed?
I pretended to be green from the start, I said. I saw how scared the PSFs were of the oranges, and I messed with the scientist who was running the classifying test. It was a struggle to push the rest of the words out. Those kids were... They were so messed up, you know? Maybe they were like that before they got their abilities, or they hated themselves for having them, but they used to do terrible things.
Like what? Chubbs pressed.
Oh, God, I couldn't even talk about it. I physically could not speak. Not about the hundreds of mind games I watched them play on the PSFs. Nothing about the memory of having to scrub the floors of the mess hall after an orange told a PSF to walk in and open fire on every other soldier he saw there. My stomach turned violently, and I could taste it, the metallic bitterness of blood. Smell it. I remembered how it felt to scrape it out from where it was packed painfully under my nails. Chubbs opened his mouth, but Liam held up a hand to shut him up. I just knew I needed to protect myself. And truthfully, because I was scared of the oranges, too. There was something wrong with them. With us. It was the constant chatter, the flood of everyone else's feelings and thoughts, I think. Eventually you learned how to block some of it out, to build up a thin wall between your mind and others, but not before everyone else's poisonous thoughts were in there, staining your own. Some spent so long outside of their own heads that they couldn't function right when they finally had to return to their own. So, now you see, I said finally, what a mistake it was to let me stay. Zoo was shaking her head, looking distraught at the suggestion. Chubbs rubbed at his eyes, hiding his expression. Only Liam was willing to look me straight in the eye, and there was no disgust or fear or any of the thousand other ugly emotions he was entitled to. Only understanding. "Try to imagine where we'd be without you, darling," he said quietly. "And then maybe you'll see just how lucky we got."
20. That night, we slept in the van, each sprawled out on a seat. I let Zoo have the rear seat and stayed up front next to Liam. I felt uneasy in the silence, and sleep didn't come easy, even when I called to it. Sometime around 5 in the morning, just as I was about to give in to the fuzz covering my brain, I felt someone run a light finger down the back of my neck. I rolled over onto my other side, and Liam was there, half awake.
"You were muttering to yourself," he whispered. "You okay?"
I propped myself up on an elbow, wiping the sleep away from my eyes. The rain had condensed on the windows, covering the cracked windshield like a filmy overlay of lace. Every time a fat raindrop dislodged itself and went streaking down the glass, it was like a tear in the fabric. Looking out into the forest was like searching someone's dreams, disorienting and unsettling. But inside the van, everything was sharp. The lines of the reclining seats, the dashboard knobs. I could even read the tiny printed brand name on the buttons of Liam's shirt. In that light, I could see every bruise and cut on his face, some just beginning to heal, and others that had long since scarred. But what held my attention wasn't the bruise on his cheek, the same one I had given him a few days and lifetimes before, but the way his hair was standing almost straight up, curling around his ears and against his neck. The storm had turned its color to a darker shade of honey, but it didn't lose any of its softness. It didn't make me want to reach out and touch it any less.
"What?" he whispered. "What are you smiling about?"
My fingers brushed against his hair, trying to smooth it down. I realized what I was doing a full minute after Liam had closed his eyes and leaned into my touch. Embarrassment flared up in my chest, but he grabbed my hand before I could pull back and tucked it under his chin.
"Nope," he whispered when I tried to tug it away. "Mine now."
"Dangerous. This is dangerous." The warning was fleeting, banished to the back corners of my mind, where it wouldn't interrupt how good it felt to touch him. How right. "I'm going to need it back eventually," I said, letting him run it along the stubble on his chin.
"Too bad." "Crackers,"
a voice breathed out behind us.
"Yes?"
Both of us turned, watching as Chubbs twisted around in his seat and settled back down, still fast asleep. I pressed a hand over my mouth to keep from laughing. Liam rolled his eyes, smiling.
"He dreams about food," he said.
"A lot."
"At least they're good dreams."
"Yeah," Liam agreed. "I guess he's lucky." I looked back at Chubbs' curled-up form and, for the first time, realized just how cold it was without the heat from Betty's vent. Liam let his head slide down to rest against his other arm, threading his fingers through mine. He seemed to be studying the shape they made, the way my thumb appeared to rest naturally on top of his.
"If you wanted to," he began, "could you see what he was dreaming about?"
I nodded. "But those things are private."
"But you've done it before."
"Not intentionally."
"To me?"
"To the girls in my cabin at camp," I said. "To Zoo that night in the motel. I've been in your head. Once. Just not in your dreams."
"2 days ago, he said, putting it together, "at the rest stop."
It was instinct to pull back, to let go before I felt him let go first, but he didn't allow me.
"Don't," he said. "I'm not mad."
He brought our hands down against his forehead, not looking at me when he asked,
"Does it make it worse? To be touching someone, I mean? Is it harder to control?"
"Sometimes," I admitted. I didn't know how to explain it, because I had never wanted to. "Sometimes, when I'm tired or upset,
I'll pick up on someone's thoughts or a memory they're thinking about, but I can avoid being pulled in if I don't touch the person. Touching them when my head is like that, it's an automatic connection.
I thought so. Liam sighed, closing his eyes again.
You know, when we first met, you used to go out of your way to avoid touching us. I kept wondering if it was something you had been trained to do at your camp, because every time one of us would try to touch you or talk to you, you'd jump like we had shocked you.
I didn't want to hurt any of you, I whispered.
His eyes flashed open again, somehow brighter than before. He nodded to our linked fingers.
Is this okay?
Are you okay? I countered. I recognized the look on his face. It was nearly identical to the grief he'd worn at the rest stop, talking about his own camp.
What are you thinking about?
I was thinking about how strange it is that we haven't even known each other for 2 weeks, but it feels like I've known you for much longer than that, he said. And I'm thinking that it's frustrating to feel like I know certain parts of you so well, but other parts of you, I don't even know what your life was like before you went to camp.
What could I tell him? What could I say about what I had done to my parents and to Sam that wouldn't scare him into letting go?
This is a place where we don't have to lie, he said, motioning between us. Didn't you tell me that?
You remember?
Of course I do, he said, because I keep hoping that goes both ways. That if I ask you why you don't want to go home to your parents, you'll tell me the truth. Or if I ask you what Thurman was really like, you'll stop lying. But then I realized that it's not fair, because it's not like I want to talk about my family. It's like those... I turned to look at him, waiting as he tried to piece together his thought.
I don't know if I can explain it, he said. It's hard to put into words. Those things, those memories, are mine, you know? They're the things that the camp didn't take away when I went in, and they're the things I don't have to share if I don't want to.
I guess that's stupid.
It's not stupid, I said. That's not stupid at all. And I want to talk about everything with you. Everything. But I don't know what to tell you about Caledonia, he said. I don't know what I can tell you that won't make you hate me. I was stupid and I'm embarrassed and ashamed, and I know that Charles and Zoo blame me for what happened. And I know that Cole has told Mom about it by now and she's told Harry, and the thought just makes me sick.
You did what you thought was right, I said. I'm sure they understand that.
He shook his head, swallowing hard. I reached over with my other hand to brush the hair out of his eyes. The way he turned his face toward me again, closing his eyes and tilting his chin, made me brave enough to do it again. My fingers followed the natural wave of his hair, tracing the strands down around his ear.
What do you want to do? I whispered.
I've got to wake the others up, he said. We have to keep moving. On foot.
My hand stilled, but it was clear that he had made his choice.
What's the rush? I asked lightly.
There, at the right corner of his mouth, where his scar met his lips, a faint smile.
I think we could let them sleep, at least for a few more hours.
And then?
We'll hit the road.
2 hours rolled right on by around us. We both must have fallen asleep at some point, because by the time I opened my eyes, the condensation was shrinking against the glass, and a few rays of morning light had made it to the forest floor. As I stirred, so did Liam. For a while, we said and did nothing beyond working out the cricks and kinks from the awkward positions we slept in. When it came time to finally let go of his hand, I felt the first touch of cold air work its way in from outside.
"Wake up, team," he said.
His shoulder popped as he reached back to slap Chubb's knee. "Time to carpe the hell out of this diem." Less than an hour later, we were standing in front of the black minivan, watching as Zoo did one last check under the seats. I buttoned my plaid shirt up to my throat and wrapped a red scarf I'd picked up around my neck 3 times, not because I was all that cold, but because it helped hide the disturbing bloodstain smeared down my front.
"Yikes,"
Liam's expression was grim as he leaned over and pulled my hair out from where it was trapped beneath the collar. "Would you rather wear mine?" I smiled and zipped his coat up for him. My forehead was still tender to the touch, and the stitches were as ugly as sin, but I was feeling better. "Was it really that bad?"
"Evil Dead too bad."
Liam bent down to add a few of his clothes to my backpack. Something red appeared in his hand.
"Just about gave me a heart attack, Green."
"You can't really call her Green anymore," Chubbs pointed out. He was making the difficult decision about which books to abandon and which to take with him, and had seemed to settle on Watership Down, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, and some book I had never heard of called Howard's End, Left Behind, The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, and The Sound and the Fury, which Chubbs had taken to calling The Snore and the Just Kill Me.
"Yeah," I said, "no more Green."
"All done?" Liam called to Zoo. When she gave him a thumbs up, he threw her pink bag over one shoulder and my backpack over the other. "Any day now, Marion Librarian? I thought you were the one that wanted to check out." Chubbs gave him the finger, leaning forward to put his full weight into closing the briefcase. I leaned over to help him, trying to avoid the look on Liam's face as he stood there staring at Betty's mangled black shell. Zoo was crying without making a sound. Liam had his hands on her shoulders, holding her steady. Even Chubbs looked at the car with a rare softness, his fingers bunching up the fabric of his pants. I understood why we were parting ways with Betty now. The other skip tracer that had been with Lady Jane was still out there, and there was some chance that the woman had reported the car to whatever bounty network the skip tracers used. But I also understood why Liam had been so reluctant to do it. Unlike the abandoned and withered small towns we had driven through in western Virginia, the nearby cities and their populations were still holding on, which meant there would be more folks on the road, and Betty, with her bullet holes and cracked windows, was not exactly inconspicuous. Then there was the fact that we had little to no gas left, and no easy way of finding more, aside from going up and down and siphoning it from the abandoned cars along the nearby highway. There was too much traffic. Too many potential eyes running down the road to do it. Liam had gotten us as close as he could to Lake Prince, but it was anyone's guess how long it would take us to walk there.
"It feels like we should do something," he said, "like send her off on a barge out to sea and set her on fire. Let her go out in a blaze of glory."
Chubbs raised an eyebrow.
"It's a minivan, not a Viking."
Zoo pulled away from his grasp and headed for the trees to her left. Liam rubbed the back of his neck, at a loss.
"Hey," he started, "it's okay, we'll..."
But when Zoo reappeared in our line of sight, she wasn't empty-handed. Clutched between her fingers were four small yellow flowers, wild weeds by the look of it, the kind we always used to have to pull up in Thurman's garden every spring. She walked over to the van, stood on her toes, and lifted up the closest windshield wiper. With delicate fingers, she positioned each flower in a row, keeping them straight across the cracked glass. Something cold and wet caught on my eyelashes. Not tears, but a misty rain, the kind that soaked through you slow and sure, driving you crazy with chills in the process. And I realized then how unfair it all was that we couldn't just crawl back inside of the car, that even if we made it to East River, we'd be soaked and sore for days. This car, this had been a safe place for them, for us. Now we had lost that, too. I shoved my hands in my pockets and turned away, heading for the trees. My fingers brushed against something hard and smooth in my pocket, and I didn't need to pull it out to know that it was the panic button. In the beginning, I had kept it because I wasn't sure I'd be able to protect them on my own. And now, I had half a mind to drop it and let the ground claim it. Liam had confirmed everything that I'd suspected, but it seemed foolish to toss it then, when there was a chance for us to use them like they would have used us. If a PSF or skip tracer caught up to us now, I could press the button, and the agents that showed up would be more than enough distraction for us to have a chance to get away. But it still didn't make me feel any less ashamed of how relieved I felt to find it still there, to know that Kate, with all of her promises to take care of things, was still out there, still only a touch away. Liam thought the easiest and fastest way to navigate our small pack to East River was to travel alongside the roads that we would have